And welcome back to the Sports Ticket here on this Wednesday, talking K-State sports, K-State in focus, brought to you by Hanson Auction Realty in Beloit and Hayek Electric in Beloit. John Kurtz with KC Sports Network has a free podcast and does a great job covering sports and, of course, knows K-State very well, and that's why we have him on today to talk K-State men's basketball. And, John, first and foremost, I mean, it's pretty amazing what K-State has done in such a short period of time under Jerome Tang, and I know a disappointing loss last night in Ames to Iowa State, but Iowa State, a top 12 team and maybe in the top 10 when the new rankings come out next week. But let's just start there with Jerome Tang and what he's been able to do in such a short period of time, because the expectations, I think, have certainly changed from, hey, let's make the tournament, to, hey, we might be a national championship contender.
Yeah, no doubt. And it's miraculous almost that he's been able to take a roster that had two guys that stuck around from last year and create a team that legitimately has dudes. Jerome Tang likes to say it like that. We've got dudes, and they definitely do. The resurgence of Keontae Johnson just a couple of years after collapsing on the court in a situation kind of similar to DeMar Hamlin of the Buffalo Bills is an amazing story, and he's now playing at an all-conference and perhaps all-American level. Marquise Noel has taken a jump from being a guy who was an honorable mention All-Big 12 player to now probably a third-team All-American, and he was very good again last night against Iowa State. Then they've sprinkled in, I mean, Naquan Tomlin, who was a JUCO player that at one point was playing at Rucker Park instead of going to high school, and I think has a lot of NBA potential. They find him. They find Desi Sills, who was a starter on an Elite Eight team at Arkansas. And then a guy like Isma Shude has taken a huge step forward from what he was last year under Bruce Weber, and again made some huge shots last night. So, yeah, they're finding ways. They're finding ways, and doing all this, by the way, without David Gasson, who I think is one of, if not their best big, if you're going to think of a big in the truest sense. And that's one of the biggest issues K-State's having right now is not rebounding well on the deep end. That hurt him a lot last night against Iowa State. So I think once he gets back healthy, they're going to be even better. So. Yeah, it's been amazing what they've been able to do, winning at Baylor, winning at Texas, beating Kansas at home. They've picked off some really big wins here, and that's why you see them in the top five going into this week, because that resume had been pretty impeccable. So combine that with just the work that Tang has done, changing everybody's attitude and, you know, getting the chant to stop. It really is. It's miraculous. It's unbelievable how much he's poured his entire heart and soul into this thing. First arriving in Manhattan, and now where they're actually at right now, I would have never guessed in a million years it would happen in year one.
Let's extend upon that point that you mentioned in regards to Coach Tang's relationship with the student body, because he reached out right away when he came in. We know many people were upset in regards to the Bruce Weber regime and students, some of them stopped coming to games. Of course, when you win, people show up. When you lose that support. That's just how it is in sports and at any level. But he really reached out to the students right off the bat, and he created a relationship with the students. And I was talking with a K-State fan, a big-time supporter here in our area, just the other night, and she was so happy that he addressed the chant, because she said, "I've been so tired of that. I've been embarrassed by that chant for decades." And she said, and I said, "Isn't that great? He was able to you know, slow this down and change the thinking of it and so forth and so on." And she goes, "I want to give him a lot of credit," but she says, "in fairness," and this is her words, not mine, because she's been around longer than I have watching K-State athletics. She said, "He was really the first coach that actually tried to do it."
He was the first coach that's tried to do it, but John Curry definitely made a push to do it. Yeah. During his time as athletic director, John Curry was not somebody that was very well liked. At the time that he was at K-State, so he was really the wrong messenger on that, and I think probably made it a little bit worse, because you got to be careful. It's a fine line with the students. You start telling them not to do something, and you appear to be, you know, kind of the pencil-pushing guy from Animal House. You know, I mean, that's not going to go over well. You're generally going to get resistance, and it's going to go the other way, and that was definitely John Curry. And really, like, the chant, I was watching highlights of, I don't remember if it was the Jacob Pullen year or the Michael Beasley year, one of those games in either 08 or 10, and there wasn't a chant there. It started kind of, like, right toward the end of my time in college, which was, like, 2011. That's really when it started, like, in earnest, so it has been a fairly recent thing, and it was when, you know, Bramlage and the Octagon of Doom had a lot more kind of angry energy, whereas right now, Jerome Tang's pushing for a more positive energy and positive vibe overall. And so the thing is, he's been the right messenger, not only because he's winning now, and he's definitely taking advantage of that and leveraged that, and he's admitted to that, which is very smart. But on top of that, yeah, he was meeting the students where they were at. He was showing enthusiasm, learning the traditions, going up and doing the Wabash with them during football season, which really helped kill it then, because that's when yep. the chant would occur, just in the Wabash at football games. It was crazy. It had gotten to that point. And when he's actually there with you, like, rocking back and forth, it makes it a lot more difficult to move forward with that chant, and I think people really started to understand. And then even when it came back during the KU game, his speech at the end of the Kansas game, I think really started to get it to click for a lot of people. He's just challenging. He's challenging K-State fans to be better, because I get it now. I mean, I used to be just on the side of, like, oh, you know, whatever, the students are going to do their thing. But his whole point has been, like, look, let's be a respected program here. We're trying to be a national championship caliber program. We don't want to be known as a school so petty as to just be lobbing chants like that out at our rival and not let that dominate our headspace. So that totally makes sense for me right now. And I've got to be honest, after listening to, I mean, Iowa State fans last night twice, yep. chanted FK State. Missouri fans during a game against Arkansas a week or two ago were chanting FKU, and it just, you kind of like roll your eyes, like, okay, that's sort of lame. And so I'm like, okay, now I understand, and I'm happy that it seems like everybody is really moving on from that here.
Yeah, me too. And I haven't liked it, especially as a parent. I know I sound like a old fuddy-duddy, but when I take my 9-year-old to a game, I don't expect that I hear it 8, 9, 10 times in a game. We went to a football game, and Oklahoma was, I think, second, third, fourth, or fifth, top five. Baker Mayfield was in town. Great football game, and that's who you should be focused on, is a team that's in the top five. Try to beat them, upset them, and K-State nearly did with Alex Delton, a quarterback. And I think I counted like 8, 9, 10 times where that FKU chant was going on, and I'm just sitting here, and like, first of all, I didn't bring my kid to hear that. Second of all, why are we worried about KU when you're not even playing them and you're playing a really good opponent in front of you? So I applaud Coach Tang, and I also, in fairness and in being critical of people saying those chants, Iowa State has sunk to that level, and they actually said F Tyrese Hunter when he was back from Texas after he transferred to Texas, Iowa State. And I just think, personally, just my two cents, I think that's going way too far, especially with a college kid. John Kurtz, KC Sports Network, does a great job covering sports, in particular with K-State. Of course, I'm sure he's excited about the Chiefs' AFC title game coming up on Sunday as well against the Bengals. But let's go back to the game yesterday. Last night, K-State falls to Iowa State. And the conference is so tough. I mean, we all know this. It's the best conference in America. And it's interesting. We were having this conversation the other day. I think last time I talked with you about the expectations for K-State men's basketball. And it was funny because I had people here that didn't really want to say it out loud, but I said it on the show, and I had a few KU fans send me a few texts. And I'm like, well, if K-State beats KU, which they did, I predicted they beat KU at least once this year, and that was about a month ago. I said, you know what? If you beat KU and you're atop the Big 12, and the Big 12 is the best conference in America, how are you not a national championship contender? And I look at this K-State team. I see how athletic they are. And you mentioned they could get even better with Gasan coming back, much like KU last year was struggling in January. And then they got Remy Martin back during the stretch run and, of course, went on to win a national championship. I'm not saying K-State's going to win at all, but it's a wide-open race in college basketball this year, and if you can be right there near the top of the Big 12, how are you not a contender to go to the Final Four and win a national title?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. Like, the fan in me has kind of been sitting around, like, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like, this yep. is too good to be true. But they just keep putting together performance after performance that makes you believe. And, you know, we talked to, on our podcast, Gary Parrish from CBS Sports, one of the best national college basketball guys out there, and I mean, he very sternly backed that up. Like, yeah, absolutely, they could be a Final Four, a national championship team this year. You know, I mean, he said, look, I play in the odds, you wouldn't outright predict it, but they're in that mix. I mean, he had them as a one seed this week when we were talking to him, which, again, just incredible to hear those words come out of somebody's mouth. But yeah, that's really the waters that they are swimming in right now. And I would actually say, I mean, the game last night, it's a loss. It's frustrating. I'm not really one for moral victories, and you're in a conference title race where it would have been great to grab that game that I think was definitely there for the taking, especially in the first half. Iowa State shot it a little bit better in the second half and came around. But I actually kind of come out of that game feeling almost in a weird way even more encouraged by it. I mean, Hilton has been a madhouse this year. The closest anybody had played Iowa State this season in Hilton had been an 11-point game, and their K-State was, you know, one possession game with under a minute to go. They were basically just needed a defensive rebound that they didn't get a couple of times off Iowa State misses in the last minute, away from having the ball with a chance to tie or take the lead. So that's an incredibly impressive effort, particularly when you think about in case they got down by 10 in the second half and things were really starting to get out of control. The crowd was totally in it. Very, very lively crowd. You know, I was seeing some of the Iowa State guys talking about it being as good as any of the KU crowds that they would have year in, year out basis there. So they were fired up. And this team just, they've got a ton of poise, a ton of toughness. They didn't flinch. And they started making some plays down the stretch and got themselves right back into the game. And it just felt like a game between two great teams that were really throwing haymakers at each other, just shot after shot after shot, especially in the second half. But wildly entertaining. I come away thinking those are two really, really good teams. And I just, when it got to 10, I thought, all right, you know, this will probably wind up being like a 15-point loss. It's okay. A lot of progress seemingly made since that game at TCU where they felt like they were kind of reading their press clippings a little bit too much, as Bill Snyder would say, and really got run out of the gym. That did not at all happen last night in Ames. So I think that toughness and you know, veteran presence that they have with a lot of these guys that have played a lot of games, I think is going to serve them well. And I think they absolutely are legit and for real. That just may mean still six losses in Big 12 play because the league is so difficult. And that might win the league. That might get you a share of the league title if you finish at 12-6. You know, Ken Pom's been predicting the league champion to be 11-7 for a long time right now. So that's just how good the league is right now. You're just going to take some of those like last night.
Well, let me ask you this, because we've been debating, or not debating, but discussing it. The expectations change so quickly. We were talking about the Chiefs the other day. Five years ago, the Chiefs get host a divisional playoff game against the Colts, and everybody's going crazy because the Chiefs won that game. Mahomes won the game, and everything's different with Mahomes. And we beat the Colts, who've been a thorn on our side in the playoffs, and we're so excited to go to the AFC title game. 5 years later, you beat the Jaguars. It's like, yeah, big deal. We're supposed to do that. Now let's just go ahead and focus on the Bengals, and you don't enjoy the win because we've been spoiled. The expectations, of course, at KU men's basketball, we've known for years. They win conference titles, tons of them. They're supposed to be a national championship contender year in and year out. Alabama football, we know all about those things. But what about on a smaller scale that's turning into a bigger scale, and that is, what were your expectations before the season began for K-State men's basketball? And what are your expectations now? Because it is interesting, as you just said, that, you know, if you were told before the season, hey, we're going to lose in Ames by 4 and be competitive, you'd be like, yeah, I take that. But based on where they were going in the game, you're kind of disappointed yet somewhat encouraged that, you know, despite losing in that performance. And going into Lawrence, you probably never thought they have a chance really to win. Now, on Tuesday, when they go into Lawrence, they're sitting there going, why can't they win 2 in a row against KU? Talk about where your expectations were and where they are now for this program.
Yeah, I think going into the year, it was really late in the process that they landed Keyonte. Before Keyonte, when the roster had kind of started to take shape, I was like, all right, you know, I mean, I think there's enough here to be competitive and hopefully not finish last in what's going to be a really tough league. Then when they added Keyonte, I was like, all right, this should be a tournament team, or at least a bubble team. You know, that's kind of what I felt, that they needed another guy who could really go score the ball and get you a bucket, and that would turn them into a team that could possibly make the NCAA tournament. So that was really like my baseline going into the season, and that didn't really change to the entire non-conference schedule. That's the interesting part about it. I mean, they looked all right, and they pulled some games, you know, a couple overtime wins out of the fire in the non-con. Had one game where they just looked like they didn't have it, and were maybe regressing a little bit against Butler. But by the end of the non-con schedule, I was not in any place where I thought, hey, this team is going to really take off on a run. I just thought, this looks like a team that probably could get you 6 or 7 Big 12 wins, which would put you on the bubble this year with how strong the league is. And then their first league game is an overtime win over West Virginia the same day as the Sugar Bowl. So I can remember watching that in New Orleans on a phone, and, you know, it seemed like they had a lot of poise there in overtime. West Virginia at the time, to be fair, was, I mean, they were pretty high up. They were like a top 20 KenPom team. So it was a nice win, but looking back on it, you know, beating West Virginia at home in overtime is not necessarily anything to write home about. But it was really the Baylor and Texas back-to-back. That's when your expectations started to shift, where you're like, okay, whoa, like you guys are capable of doing this. That is when they really took a jump. And, you know, what are my expectations now? I still try not to get too carried away, just because I don't want to ruin this season and ruin how fun this is and how great it appears that things are
sure.
are going and heading in the direction that Jerome Tang has been pulling them in. But I would say, you know, I mean, it seems like now I would think when the dust settles, they're probably going to be 12-6, 11-7 in the Big 12. I would think that's going to be good enough to get you around a 4 seed in the NCAA tournament. And, you know, I would hope that they could make it to the second weekend, but you never know, really, in the NCAA tournament. So I was kind of like around where my expectations would be of what this team is with the ceiling of, for sure, they could be a Final Four team, and a floor of, I don't, you know, maybe they really go on a rough stretch here and finish like 10-8 in the Big 12 and more like a 6 seed or something like that. But when that's, we're talking about that as like the floor for this team based on where things were not that long ago. That's a great place to be in.
John Kurtz, KC Sports Network, is with us talking K-State athletics. K-State in Focus, brought to you by Hanson Auction Realty in Beloit, Heineken Electric in Beloit as well. The rivalry between KU and K-State, I think it's only enhanced when both schools have good coaches in the main sports. And I'm talking men's basketball and football, of course. And it looks like KU has the right man in Lance Leipold, and KU fans were pinching themselves when they were 5-0 and ESPN Game Day was coming to town. And it's interesting, K-State fans have gone through a similar situation, obviously, Jerome Tang, although in his first year doing it, Lance Leipold in his second, but Jerome Tang, suddenly, boom, you're a top five team already, and we're here in late January, and you're being interviewed after a win over KU by Scott Van Pelt on SportsCenter, and getting all kinds of recognition for your basketball program. And you know, to me, that's what's going to make this rivalry great, is that you actually have a coach in place that I think is actually a ball coach and not a retread at KU for football. And K-State's got a fresh new face with a new voice, with a tremendous passion and energy for the game, and not only the game, but for his kids as well. And now it feels like that this rivalry is going the right direction, because honestly, yeah, it's been a rivalry, but it's not. We've heard coaches, we've heard players say it, you know, until you start beating each other on a somewhat regular basis, or you actually steal one in the other team's home court or football field, kind of missing something.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it's that there are a lot of parallels on both sides. Now, I think what Jerome Tang is doing is on a higher level in terms of, you know, what the ceiling for the season is than what Lance Leipold was doing, but a lot of that is just the nature of the sport,
yep.
Right? It's a lot easier to rebuild quickly in basketball because there are such, you know, so many fewer players that you need, and you don't have to recruit quite as regionally. You can go more nationally. So it's not like, you know, K-State being good at basketball is not really an existential threat, I think, to Kansas basketball, because both places could just recruit nationally. You could conceivably, I think, have two powers there. Football, that's a little different, and why it gets dicey, and you know why I think you get nervous if you're a K-State fan about Lance Leipold there, because there are a limited amount of resources. You're already getting a pretty good fight these days from Iowa State for a lot of the kids around the area. So I think that adds a little bit of element to that rivalry as well. But I, you know, you're seeing, I think, both fan bases be a little leery, a little nervous about the opposite coach there. And during football season, it was a lot of K-State fans pointing out that the Wisconsin and Nebraska jobs were open, and like, hey, you know, this guy may be up and out. And now you're seeing a lot of Jerome Tang to Texas chatter from KU fans,
yeah.
Because they would certainly like to see that happen. But I do think in general, yeah, it makes the rivalry a lot more fun in basketball. You know, the Frank Martin years were pretty fun. And even with that, you know, I mean, Frank only beat Kansas twice, the two home games. So, Tang made the point going into the KU game, like, hey, if we're going to call it a rivalry, we're going to have to start winning some of these games. Off to a good start at 1-0, but that'll be the difference, I think, if he can actually get those guys to the point where they can win more consistently at home and have a chance to swipe one and out in Fieldhouse. Because I mean, Frank's teams, it was just, I can remember getting bombed by the first media timeout almost every single time they were in there. Bruce had teams that played better in Allen Fieldhouse, which I think my theory on that is just that he had some teams that didn't catch Kansas's attention nearly as much. So they got some lesser efforts from KU out of that. And K-State's certainly not going to get that on next Tuesday.
No.
I mean, we'll see what happens this weekend with Kentucky, but especially, I mean, if Kansas is riding a four-game losing streak, into that one and then looking for revenge at home, I mean, I don't – you're going to get a pretty fired up crowd and a pretty fired up Kansas, I would have to think. So we'll see. That to me will be one of the real barometers here. Can you keep that thing in Lawrence at least really competitive like the Iowa State game?
Yeah.
Because that Hilton's a comparable atmosphere, and it gave me some hope, to be honest, for the Kansas game. That's a part of my takeaway from last night. Like, if these guys can be that tough and withstand, you know, the pressure in those moments. I mean, Allen is a better atmosphere than Hilton, for sure, and that building just has a history of swallowing people up. But if you look at this year, I mean, TCU absolutely crushed Kansas in Allen. Oklahoma was up 10 with 5 minutes left. Iowa State, it went down to the final possession. Oklahoma State was up 15 at halftime in Allen. Yep. Like, yeah, that's a game that should be out there for the taking this year based on what Kansas has put out there. So I'll be looking for that, because I think Frank, even as good as he was at times with his teams, they never really handled that very well at all.
I truly believe that K-State can win in Lawrence. I do, coming up on Tuesday, because of the things you just mentioned, and KU is not – they're challenged at times offensively. There's no doubt about it. Too much is on the shoulders of Grady Dick, a freshman, and Jalen Wilson, and so they need McCullough to really step up. KJ Adams, when they were doing well, was scoring in double figures. So that's something to keep an eye on, because Adams has not been scoring as much during this KU losing streak. But you know as well as I do that KU is going to figure some things out, and they're going to bounce back at some point, and that's the scary part. And you mentioned KU playing Kentucky, but K-State's got a game, and I know Florida's not Kentucky, although Kentucky doesn't have the greatest record of all. They're not even ranked, but Florida's 11-8, and so if you're K-State, I know it's a non-con game, but you got to be a little bit leery of looking past Florida to the KU game on Tuesday, don't you?
Probably so, but I think there's one key factor here that's going to keep that from happening.
Keontae Johnson?
And that is Keontae Johnson, yep. Because he obviously played at Florida. That's where he had his heart condition, where he collapsed on the floor. There was a game earlier this year, K-State played Radford. I believe it was Radford who had a coach on their staff. I don't know. Maybe it was the head coach. One of the coaches on their staff was an assistant at Florida, and Jerome Tang or one of the assistants, somebody spoke afterward about Keontae pressing a little bit, trying to do a little bit too much, because he kind of, you know, with the idea of being like wanted to show out for his coach. So I think you're going to get Keontae's focus, and I think because of that, you're going to get the team's focus and everybody wanting to win and play well and help Keontae play well just in a game that's going to mean a lot to him. So I like the fact that it's that instead of, you know, I mean, like K-State's done, like Texas A&M in this before, Ole Miss. I think that could be much tougher, and I would be more leery of a letdown because of that. So they've Tang's made a huge point about that TCU game being kind of a letdown game and trying to move past that and not do that anymore. So I think that we're going to avoid that on Saturday, and they should be fine. It's if you ask KenPom, I mean, it's the easiest game left on the schedule because the Big 12 is so tough, mm-hmm. You know, taking on a middle-of-the-pack SEC team at home. So it really is a game K-State should win, kind of a get-right, feel-better-about-yourself game, pick up some momentum again, and then, hey, go lace them up in one of the toughest places to go get a win in college hoops.
Right, let's change gears for a quick moment before the off-the-wall question. John Kurtz is with us, KC Sports Network. Check out his work there, also on YouTube. The Chiefs host the AFC title game for the 50 in a row. They get the Cincinnati Bengals. And I've been trying to tell people we really need to stop and appreciate how great a run this is. Five straight AFC title games is amazing in itself. To host every one of them is amazing in itself. And at the same time, and these are the expectations we were talking about earlier, and this was supposed to be kind of a retooling year for the Chiefs, trading Tyreek Hill, you know, freeing up some cap space. They got lots of young players, draft picks. They're set up really well for the next few years. Everybody spent a ton of money to try to beat the Chiefs, and they actually fell further behind. But the one team that's kind of been the thorn in their side the last three times out, obviously the Bengals. But the thing that we were pointing out is that Andy Reid, his legacy would have been so much more had he won a Super Bowl in Philadelphia, had he gone to more Super Bowls, only I think when he went to one, and he went to the NFC title game multiple times, three straight years at home, and just didn't get as many wins as you'd like when you get that far. And it's one thing to get that far and do that so often. It's another to actually break through and win a Super Bowl. The Chiefs have done that, and they went to the Super Bowl again and lost to the Buccaneers. But the point I'm trying to make here, John, is how important is this game for the Chiefs organization? And people want to talk about dynasty, which I think you have to win at least two to even be in that discussion. The Chiefs are stuck at one. And then the fact that they got to play a team that came back and beat them last year on their home field and is beating them three straight times. if the Chiefs lose this game on Sunday, and I know they're an underdog right now, and if it were me, I'd pick the Bengals to win because I think they're the more complete team at the moment. But the Chiefs would be 2-3 in AFC title games, have this unbelievable 5-year run, 7 straight divisional titles, and have just one ring to show for it. Are we worried at all maybe that the Chiefs are going down the road? The comparison I've used is I don't want them to become the Atlanta Braves of Major League Baseball, who won one World Series and won 14 straight division titles.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have a little bit of concern about that. I would say I think this year, with what Pat has done after losing Tyreek Hill, really proves how much of a contender they're going to be year in, year out.
I agree.
They're not going to go away anytime soon. Being able to take this kind of, you know, hodgepodge of decent weapons, but not anything spectacular outside of Travis Kelce, really mainly talking receivers there, and do what he's done, I think he's been incredible and is very, very encouraging, bodes well for the future. But, I mean, the point about, I think the real thing that the scale tips on here is does the Chiefs, quote-unquote, dynasty continue to go, and I don't, you know, I'm using the term loosely, dynasty, sure, there, but being like the team in the AFC, does that continue? Or, I mean, if you lose, there's really no argument to the Bengals being that team at this point, you know, would have beaten you 4 times now in just over a calendar year, twice at home in the playoffs, twice at home in that AFC championship game, making another Super Bowl appearance, Joe Burrow playing the way he is. I would not be able to argue at that point. And I can't argue, right? You know, I see the Eli Apple and the Bengals guys on the sideline calling it Burrowhead, like, well, we'll see you in Burrowhead next week. And I'm like, I'm not even really mad. They've earned that with what they've done. So I'm definitely nervous about the game. I still feel great about the – I think, you know, I don't think Pat's going to be Aaron Rodgers and only win one throughout his entire career. He's just too good and has been able to lift up, again, a team without Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce going at the same time. So I'm okay with that in the long term, but in the short term, with the high ankle sprain, if it were not for the high ankle thing, I would pick Pat and the Chiefs to win, even though, you know, the Bengals scare the absolute heck out of me. But with that, with him being gimpy, it's just so tough to know. And the Bengals are so confident, have been playing well, have the Chiefs number. I really worry about the Chiefs defense because it seems like, you know, Spags has tried a couple of different strategies against them. Neither have been very successful. So I would lean Bengals, but I also were kind of in that, like, over my dead body mode from Patrick Mahomes right now, playing through an injury and being as focused as he possibly can. And you know, for him, I'm sure the fire still burns inside about what happened in the second half last year in that AFC title game. So I will never count that guy out.
Yep.
But, yeah, I'm thinking Bengals close, but as intrigued to watch this football game as I think I've been to watch a football game in a really long time.
The amazing addition to Patrick Mahomes' legacy, if he goes out there, high ankle sprain, and plays great, and the Chiefs win, that'll just add to his legacy. Also add to Andy Reid. And because I think there's a lot of pressure on him to have a, you know, a terrific game plan working around that injury with Mahomes. And I've said maybe it's a blessing in disguise a little bit from the standpoint that it might keep him in the pocket more. And he's the number one pocket passer in the league. Well, all kinds of metric and stats you can look up there. But gets all caught up in him rolling out and making plays, which he does make amazing plays when he gets out of the pocket too. And then Andy, one of the biggest, you know, criticisms I had, and I go back to the second half last year against the Bengals, is they were giving you the running game. You were averaging 5 to 6 yards a carry, and you just went away from it. If you take what the defense gives you, I'm still convinced they win the game last year. And so that might force him to, you know, run the ball more and protect Patrick a little bit more. And then the other part of it, and I don't know if you believe in this or not, but do you think that in these situations that everybody else, it creates a little more laser focus when you know Mahomes isn't 100%, the offensive line plays better, the defense elevates themselves? Because the Chiefs did that when he was out for a couple games after the dislocated kneecap against Denver, and they seem to have done that. You know, certainly Chad Henne helped coming in and playing great too. It seems like guys came even more focused because they knew that their leader was hurt. Do you buy into that?
Yeah, I do. I think that does heighten everybody's focus, and particularly, you know, I think you saw that, like, on the Chad Henne drive, that everybody's like, all right, we got to step up our game here and help out, because all of a sudden we don't have 15 to just bail us out all the time. So I do think that is a possibility and something we'll likely see. And I mean, they need it. The most frustrating piece, I think, of the entire team to me is Orlando Brown. And obviously he's the guy that got beat that led to the play with this high ankle sprain even happening. And he's the one that, like, look, if it's Orlando Brown to elevate his play somehow from being just a very average left tackle with a hefty price tag, that would be wonderful, because I do worry about that. I'm with you. I've seen the metrics and the numbers that Pat is better than anybody else in the league in the pocket, whatever statistical category you want to throw out there. But they're also, they've got to protect him.
Yep.
You know, they've got to give him time. And, you know, Cincinnati really beat up the Bills up front,
they did.
Like on both sides. So I do think that is a major concern.
That, and it'd be nice to bring down Burrow a few times, which they couldn't do last year in the AFC title game, and the Bengals have some backups on the line, but they dominated the Bills, so who knows. But I'm with you. I would have rather played a neutral site game in Atlanta against the Bills than have a home game against the Bengals. That's just me, but maybe I'm just a scaredy cat because the Bengals had the Chiefs' number. And we got to remember all three games were field goal games that could easily have all gone the Chiefs' way too, so we got to stay optimistic. John, time for the off-the-wall question before we let you go. What is one rule change that you would like to see in college men's basketball? What would be, if you had to pick one thing you'd like to change about college men's basketball in regards to a rule, what would it be?
That's a good question. I'm not crazy about all the flop. I guess it's not really a warning even more. It's a flop, you know, the flop technical, that's where you get a free throw out of it. I just think that's too subjective, too hard to make a judgment call on an individual basis. So I'm not a huge proponent of that. I think I might go ahead and axe that, get rid of that.
Mm. My change would be to go to four quarters, like the women do and the NBA does. And I think you would have less of these, everybody's in the bonus with 13 minutes to go in the second half and turn into a free throw contest. I think for the rhythm of the game and for the athletes themselves, you'd have more continuity. You reset the fouls each quarter. You'd have more last-second situations, obviously, with you at the end of the quarter. And I just kind of like the flow of the game more when you go to four quarters instead of two halves. I don't think that we're going to – well, maybe we'll see it change at some point, but I don't think it will anytime soon. But that would be the one I would change. I don't know if you like that or not.
I could definitely get behind it because, you know, watching some women's basketball games with it, I think you're right. There is a pretty good flow to it. I thought at first, you know, I mean, that seemed like a jarring change, and I was like, all right, I mean, let's see what this actually looks like. But, yeah, no, it flows fine. I don't think there's anybody that – I guess I shouldn't speak for that, not like I know what the climate is around women's basketball fans at the moment, but it doesn't seem like there's been a ton of pushback to it. So, yeah, I could get behind it for sure. I would not complain.
All right, John. So where can people catch your work, man? I know you're busy covering everything. It's a busy week, a busy time of the year for college athletics and, of course, with pro sports too.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the biggest thing that I've got going right now is my YouTube channel, just John Kurtz on YouTube. But that's a Big 12 focused, conference realignment focused channel. Do a couple of live shows a week and then put another content as well, but we've got over 15,000 Big 12 fans on there. It's a pretty fun time with the live shows, just talking with a bunch of Big 12 fans, especially the four incoming schools. A lot of them joining up there. And then if you want K-State specific content, you can find my podcast on the KC Sports Network. It's just Three Maw, like E-Maw, but with a three, that I do with Cole Manbeck and Derek Young. You can find that wherever you get podcasts, Apple, Google, Spotify, et cetera. You can find that there. And then you can follow me on Twitter as well, just JL Kurtz, JLKURTZ, if you'd like to get tweets and updates by the minute, basically, because I'm on it way too much. So that's how you can find my content.
John, I always enjoy following your work. You do a wonderful job and appreciate the time. And it is an exciting time for KC Athletics, no doubt about it. The football team, of course, going to the Sugar Bowl, and the men's basketball team rated fifth in the country. So it's a great time to be a Wildcat. Thank you so much for your time. We'll talk again later on this year.
All right, perfect. Sounds good, Wade. Thanks.